Lecture 29, Locke's Newtonian Science of the Mind.
I should think it's entirely fitting, if not inevitable, that the age of Newton would also host the first Newtonian philosophy of mind, the first, as it were, Newtonian psychology. And credit for that, I think quite properly, goes to John Locke, whose dates are 1632 to 1704, a younger contemporary of Newton's, and one who would become his friend in 1689, the year in which an essay concerning human understanding was published. Now, John Locke is one of the most influential philosophers in modern history. His father fought for the parliamentarians in the Civil War, giving Locke a pedigree different from that of Hobbes. It would be a pedigree not without negative consequences in Locke's lifetime. Well, we find him at Oxford in 1652, remaining there 15 years from that point until he became a personal physician and friend to Ashley Cooper, the first Earl of Shaftesbury. Locke joins the Earl's household in 1667, but retains his Oxford studentship until it would be revoked by royal decree in 1684. You've got to be careful with your politics in the 17th century. There's a fine portrait of Locke hanging in the Great Hall of Christ Church. It was at Oxford, but apparently not until 1660, that he met and befriended Robert Boyle, the celebrated chemist, whose experimental work would bring fame to him and to Oxford. Now, during this same time in Oxford, in 1665, Locke discovers the recent work of the now deceased Descartes and recognizes its clear superiority over the scholastic philosophy that had been a staple in his own education. Locke was trained as a physician. He was one of the few people during the early decades of the Royal Society to be elected a regular fellow of the Society, chiefly on the basis of contributions of a philosophical rather than an experimental or scientific nature. His election is in the same year that he correctly diagnosed a grave condition suffered by Ashley Cooper and presided over the dangerous but finally successful operation that removed a cyst on the liver of Ashley Cooper. So I do want to say that although Locke was not an experimental scientist, he was recognized as an extremely capable physician and, of course, as a great student of science. Locke was committed to a scientific approach to the mind and society. His essay concerning the human understanding makes it quite clear that progress here must be slow and deliberate. He says that in an age that includes the great Newton and Huygens and Christopher Wren, it would be sufficient for someone like himself to work, he says, as an under laborer, to make a clearing so that others might be able to make further progress. Nonetheless, it's a quite thick treatise that he offers. Such progress, however, can be made only when we adopt methods and perspectives characteristic of Newtonian science. So Locke becomes a central figure in that part of the history of philosophy, sometimes dubbed British empiricism. We can say that it begins with Francis Bacon's Novum Organum, and it will feature centrally John Locke and George Berkeley, David Hume, John Stuart Mill, and other now lesser known but quite influential philosophers. Now, to say that Locke had committed himself to a Newtonian approach to the issue of mind and the issue of human understanding requires us to rehearse for a moment what that approach is all about. First, of course, Newton famously idealizes complex phenomena. That is, he develops a simple model in which only one or two variables are operating to see how the phenomenon comes about in the ideal case, and then he can try to approximate ever more closely to the actual physical situation through observation and experiment. Now, the other feature of Newtonian science is its ontology. That is to say, Newton begins with the assumption that the ultimate constituents of reality are obviously not the visible, palpable form presented to the senses, but some more elementary and indeed some ultimately atomic form, that the ultimate constituents of reality, the point I want to make is, are not visible things. They're small. And to use the Newtonian terms, they are corpuscular. Light itself is a phenomenon made up of invisibly small corpuscles. And matter, in any form that it might take, is ultimately, at least in principle now, reducible to some more fundamental atomic or corpuscular ontology. So, this ontology is not unlike what has been defended by Pierre Gassendi, the Francis Bacon of France, in his revival of the atomism of Democritus. It's a common feature of 17th century scientific thought, whether in Galileo or in Newton or in Gassendi, namely that complex phenomena are to be reduced, which is to say resolved into parts, at least in theory, to more elementary components. And at the elementary level, you see how things are going, and then you pull these together in order to recreate, here's the compositive process, to recreate, to build things up to reality as it is seen. The scientific understanding just is the resolution into parts and their recomposition as functioning wholes, either in fact or in theory, either actually or ideally. Now, Locke's approach is very much along these lines, patterned after the science of Newton, the science of Newton and Bacon. Well, what are the most elementary ingredients of the human understanding, asks Locke. In fact, the central question that the essay begins with is how the mind comes to be furnished at all. How do we have anything in our mind at all? And what is it that's there? Now, let's understand what he's not going to accept. He's not going to accept innate ideas, understood as ideas that, quote, the soul receives in its very first being and brings into the world with it, close quote. He doesn't mention Descartes by name when he rejects the theory of innate ideas. He probably knew of Descartes' explicit repudiation of a form of the theory of innate ideas captured by the quotation I just read. A group of philosophers at Cambridge, however, called the Cambridge Platonists, had already begun to restore respectability to these intuitive Platonic forms of knowledge, forms of knowing based on reason as such that do not require the exercise of the senses, in any case that couldn't be verified or vindicated by any possible experience. You see, the Cambridge Platonists. Thus, it is against teachings of that kind, represented in the works of people like Glanville and Ralph Cudworth, Henry Moore, that Locke's critique of innate ideas is most sharply directed. However, Locke is prepared to accept that there are what he calls certain original acts of the mind. That is, there are some things we obviously do not need experience for, and indeed would have to be present for there to be any kind of rational or mental life at all. Now, an example of this is the law of contradiction. A thing cannot simultaneously be and not be. So there is some basic logical feature of all thought. And Locke is not at pains to establish that this comes about. He's not going to try to prove that you could come to these reckonings by learning. There are some things we know immediately and certainly on first examination, and this indicates a mental power that we generally call intuitive. Locke is prepared to accept that. In other words, he's not the most radical of empiricists. Now, there are other things that can be known to be true, and certainly true, true in all contexts and in all circumstances. For example, the proofs of geometry. Now, the difference between geometry and intuitive knowledge, like the law of contradiction, is that geometric proofs indeed have to be proven through a series of formal arguments. When we reach a conclusion in the science of geometry or in abstract mathematics, we recognize that the truth of the conclusion is necessary. It's certainly true, true in all cases. But nonetheless, it does require an argument. So here's an instance not of what Locke calls intuitive knowledge, but of what, following the tradition, Locke calls demonstrative knowledge. You know such truths by demonstration, in the older Aristotelian sense of demonstration, a form of argument that successfully leads to a certain conclusion. So here we have two modes of knowing, the intuitive and the demonstrative. But when it comes to the facts of the external world, the matter is entirely different. All ideas come from sensation or reflection. Let us then suppose, says Locke, the mind to be, as we say, white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. How comes it to be furnished? Whence comes it by that vast store which the busy and boundless fancy of man has painted on it with an almost endless variety? To this I answer in one word, from experience. But of course, if we examine for a moment what we do know generally is of a very complicated sort. Just think of a demonstration in mathematics itself. Think of the knowledge of a lectern, or a camera, or lenses. Think of a knowledge of the state, politics, law. Now, how does one approach the vastness and complexity and incredible interconnectedness and subtlety that is the human understanding? This doesn't sound at all like atoms or corpuscles. Well, obviously, it doesn't begin that way de novo. We don't begin by knowing about cameras and politics. This isn't something an infant comes into the world knowing. So what we take to be the complex understandings we have must be accumulated over a course of a lifetime. So where does it all begin? Now, true to his empiricistic commitments, Locke has the process begin with sensation, the most elementary act, predating anything that's going to constitute the complex contents of the human understanding. At the fundamental level, it is the sensory act. The most elementary contents of the mind are sensations. What enters the mind first enters there by way of the senses. All of the facts of the external world present themselves to and through those sensory channels, uniquely equipped to pick up information in the external world. In his essay, he rehearses the famous Molyneux problem. The Irish philosopher and scientist Molyneux had raised the question. He and Locke were correspondents. He had raised the question whether a man born blind and subsequently as a result of surgery given sight would be able to recognize visually what he had long learned how to recognize tactually. Now, the discussion of the question is in Book 2, Chapter 9 of Locke's essay. That is, a blind person who can feel around the edges of a rectangle or any other regular object such that he would always be able to recognize it as a square or a rectangle or a circle, now he has the cataracts removed that had been present at birth. So the question is, would he be able to look at the objects in the external world that he so readily could identify tactually and identify which ones were squares, triangles, blue, etc., visually? Locke answers the Molyneux problem as you might expect. On gaining sight, the person could have no appreciation of the visible shape of objects, let alone their colors. That a person born blind and at a later time in life coming to have sight for the first time would be a babe in the woods. There wouldn't be anything he could know by way of some other sense that would give him direct knowledge now about the elements of a visible world which he has just come to. Elementary sensations must be combined and held together in some fashion. Do you see? Here's the problem. You start off with elementary sensations. But when we talk about cameras and lecterns, etc., we're not talking about particles now. We're talking about integrated wholes. So what has to happen is there has to be a means by which these elementary corpuscles, as it were, these corpuscular elements of mind can be pulled together. Any perceived object has many properties that go beyond elementary sensations. So in the particular case of a lectern on which today's notes might rest, first, it has a nearly square shape or a rectangular shape. It's a bit rounded at the top. It has a certain color to it. If I feel it, it even has a temperature. It's a little bit cooler than room temperature. It has solidity and mass. It can be made to stimulate my auditory system. I can do this. I can make a sound on it. It does stimulate my visual system. It provides information that is tangible. And I suppose at some level, it probably would have a recognizable odor. And if I started chewing on the edge of it, I would say it probably has some sort of taste, even a recognizable form sort of taste. Now, these quite complex features are not themselves elementary sensations. So how do they come together? How does all of this going on finally constitute the experience of a lectern? Locke takes up the question in several places, but most directly in Book 2, Chapter 33 of the essay, the chapter he titles, Of the Association of Ideas. Now here he cites any number of ways thinking is led astray by custom and habit, and argues that it's important for children to be watched closely lest they begin to form the wrong sorts of association. A fair bit of his discussion considers forms of madness as best explained in terms of radically faulty associations. This is Locke the doctor speaking now. In general, Locke explains the process as the result of regularly associated experiences and what might be called their reasonable connections. The elementary sensations are joined together much as the corpuscular elements of the physical world are held together by gravity to form more complex structures. The elementary sensations comprise something of a Newtonian mental realm. Now the corpuscular components of external reality we know are held together by gravitational forces. So, the corpuscular mental elements can be held together by a kind of association, associational process, maybe we can say functioning in gravitational fashion. Now, Locke does not examine the mechanisms in any detail, and he makes clear that he's content not to speculate at that level, at the level of brain physiology, etc. Throughout the essay, there are references to the corpuscular nature of the physical world and the biological structures of the body, so it is clear that his understanding of the microstructure of experience is Newtonian. He is also well aware of such truisms as practice makes perfect. And as with all of us, he knows that we do learn by association. Aristotle went so far as to theorize on the subject. Now, only later in the work of David Hume and then again in John Stuart Mill's Psychology do we find a systematic account of what we come to call the laws of association. But Locke is satisfied that the principle of association is the binding principle by which elementary sensations can be forged into more complex ideas. Sensations are held together by an essentially associative process. Those events which we experience together frequently come to be associated together. It's a virtual characteristic of mental dynamics or mental life, that where two events are joined together in our experiences, each of them comes to be associated with the other. So out of these elementary sensations, we're able to form, by an associative process, what Locke refers to as simple ideas. And of course, out of a congeries of simple ideas, we are able to form ever more complex ideas. Again, it is by way of such processes or binding forces in the understanding that the understanding comes to be furnished with ever more complex ideas. The question, then, is the extent to which the ideas that we have faithfully mirror what, in fact, is in the external world. That is, Locke has to deal with skeptical challenges. This, of course, has been a fundamental aspect of the problem of knowledge since the pre-Socratics. Can we trust the senses? How good are they at recording and reporting and faithfully representing the facts of the external world? Now, on this matter, Locke's approach to the problem of knowledge finds him adopting what might be called a dualistic epistemology. He is a realist when it comes to certain attributes we perceive in the external world and the faithfulness with which we recover and have a realistic representation of these things. But he is also what might be called a phenomenalist when it comes to other properties in the external world, and I want to make this clear. Let me use the lectern again as an illustration. We accept that physically the lectern is made up of matter whose corpuscular structure is sufficiently dense to give the lectern hardness. I'm going to hit the lectern again. It's a way of illustrating its hardness. Now, I can actually feel that hardness. The sensation I have by way of touch actually reports the physical property that corresponds to the sensation itself. I feel it as hard, and indeed it is hard. Which is to say, whatever it is in the physics that's creating hardness is also reported by the relevant sensory system. I am able to detect, report, record, and know what Locke refers to here as the primary quality of the thing, the primary quality, in this case, hardness. One of the primary qualities is hardness. It's what is there actually. Now, another of the primary qualities of an object in the external world is extension. I feel the lectern to be very nearly square or square-like, and in fact it is. So I have a direct knowledge, so to speak, of the primary qualities of things when it comes to extension and hardness. Now, what about the color of the thing? Suppose I say this, well, the lectern looks to me to be a sort of tannish, grayish, maybe dark oak. Are we to assume that at the corpuscular or atomic, or today we might say at the quantum level, we're dealing with little quanta that have gray or oak colorations, or that if I see a blue dress or a blue suit, that the ultimate constituents, the ultimate atomic or subatomic or quantum structure of that dress or that jacket is invisibly tiny things that are themselves blue? Obviously not. Rather, something in the physics of the object is interacting with something unique to my physiology in order to create the experience of color. It's not that the color itself is in the ultimate physical constituents of the thing, but something is in the ultimate physical constituents of the thing capable of exciting the experience of color in percipients biologically constituted in a certain way. Oh my. Well, color then stands in Locke's theory of the understanding as what he calls a secondary quality, taking that term from Boyle. Now note, it's not chimerical, it's not a hallucination. There really is a bona fide physical, physiological relationship between a specific property in the material world and the sensation that it reliably excites in all normal visual systems of a certain kind. So the difference between a primary and a secondary quality is that the primary quality is not only in the object, but it is in the experience itself. Whereas the secondary quality, though produced by something in the object itself, is not in that in the form that we have it by way of experience. Now, in the same vein, Locke distinguishes sharply between two senses of essence when we claim to know what something is essentially. Now, this is a very complex subject, this subject of essentialism. What does it mean to say a thing is essentially a kind of thing? To say, for example, that man is essentially a rational animal, or that apples are essentially fruit. The distinction Locke offers is at the fundamental ontological level. In point of fact, everything is reducible to an elementary corpuscular materiality, of which we never have direct immediate knowledge whatever. We do not know the real essence of anything, for we have no perceptual power able even equal to the task. The real essence of material objects is what stimulates and brings about experience. And on the basis of these experiences, we do come to classify things according to their properties. But the classifications are in the form of names we give to things: animals, fruits, furniture, wagons. Now, such designations are what Locke calls the nominal essence, which is based on convention and pragmatic considerations. So remember now what we're dealing with. We're making a distinction between something's real essence, and that's going to be at a corpuscular subatomic level. We have no access to that, no experiential access to that at all, and the nominal essence As these subatomic events give rise to experiences in us, we assign names to cover the experiences, and that's the nominal essence of a thing. That's the sense in which the nominal essence of an apple includes such things as sweet, round, reddish, grown on trees, etc. Now, all this leaves room for a certain skepticism about the knowledge claims we might be prepared to make. It's an invitation to the view that there are features of the external world which, because they are mediated by organs of perception and sensation, can never be known as in fact they really are. They can be only known in this sort of mediated psychological way. At first blush, one might be inclined to challenge all this on the grounds that there's at least one entity not known nominally, but immediately, really, and without any reliance on convention or on the facts of the external world. Well, one knows oneself, essentially, for one is essentially one's personal identity. So how will Locke deal with this? What's the basis upon which I come to know myself as the entity I am? How do I have this continuing personal identity anyway? After all, at every moment in time, that corpuscular material structure of mine, well, that's in constant flux. That's changing all the time. Every cell is undergoing modification. And most of these cells are doomed to die in short order and be replaced by others anyhow. But through it all, one remains who one is. Is this not evidence of that very substantialism, that very theory of essential substances for which the scholastics were to be held in such contempt? Now, I'll be too brief here. This is a vast, vexing, and wonderful subject of great intrigue, no small amount of amusement in it. It has ancient foundations. Plutarch, in his Life of Theseus, tells us that ancient philosophers argued over the matter. After all, after Theseus escaped the labyrinth, he makes his way back to Athens by ship, returning as a hero. Then legend has it that the ship of Theseus survives, but over the course of years, the old wood is replaced with new planks. Year after year, more new planks, the old stuff goes away. Now, here's the philosophical question. At what point is it no longer the ship of Theseus? It has some sort of continuing identity, but none of the original parts remains. Similarly with the human body. Thing is changing all the time, constant alterations, cells being replaced all the time. How do we get out of all this some essential self, distinguishable from matter? Well, Locke regarded personal identity as the gift of experience. He's an empiricist, so self just is an accumulation of experiences, memories, present in consciousness, held together within the understanding by that very process of association that's been discussed. Well, when Locke puts together a theory of this kind, that personal identity is no more than a history of experiences held together by associative principles, great wits come together and say, we've had enough of this philosophy. The group that attacks philosophical pretensions come to call themselves Scriblerians, after a character in Arbuthnot called Dr. Scriblerus. Jonathan Swift is a Scriblerian, and Alexander Pope is a Scriblerian. And the Scriblerians have a wonderful time with Locke on personal identity, so that if, in fact, my personal identity is just my history of experience, whatever I have in memory, Locke says if you put the memories of a cobbler into the consciousness of a prince and vice versa, on the next day, Locke says, the two would wake up. They'd be the same man, but not the same person. Because a farmer or a cobbler who now has all of the experiences of a prince would awaken with the personal identity of a prince, and the prince would just be a cobbler or a peasant. And the Scriblerians look at this and say, ah, this is philosophy run amok. After all, Jack kills Bill. As Bill falls to the ground, he's having different experiences. He must be a different person by the time he hits the ground from the person he was just before the time that he was attacked by his assailant. That you couldn't even have a court trial on this account. The idea that your personal identity merely is a collection of things that you remember is an absurdity. Well, philosophers very often come up with theories that seem to have absurd implications, and sometimes the philosophers who do this are very great philosophers. John Locke was a very great philosopher, and I think his theory of personal identity is hopelessly defective. We shall return to this from time to time in the course of lectures. Anyway, that's what one of the fathers of modern empiricism serves up as a robust philosophy of mind, compatible with what he took to be the best science of the age, the science of Newton.